Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. It's your boy. Okay, I'm not going to say that anymore because that's dumb. It's Z-Dog MD, a.k.a. Dr. Zubin Demanya. I'm just Z, all right? Just call me that and we're all good. Anyway, so we're excited because we're doing a Tom and Z morning rounds. Whether or not it's morning, we don't care. Time is relative and it's an animal construct. So today we are going to try to talk about pricing in healthcare, in honor of Dr. Marty McCary, who was on our show recently, and his book is coming out today, September 10th, 2019, The Price We Pay. It's available on Amazon. We'll put links in the thing and all that. And basically, it's a real tour de force about just how shitty our healthcare system is about price transparency, price gouging, suing its own patients, unnecessary care, over treatment, over testing. Basically, this is why it's $3.2 trillion. And then people want to cover it all with Medicare for All, which is a terrible idea because you're paying for something that already sucks. And then you're going to, and then the people say, oh, well, Tom, you know, if you do Medicare for All, the government will force industry to behave itself. How many times has that worked?
Exactly zero.
Zero. So what'll happen is you'll just codify a broken system and then you'll put draconian top-down measures to control it. It will end up stifling innovation and causing people to leave the field. What we need to do is we need a true competition, a true price transparency, along with some government regulation and guidance that allows it to flourish instead of the crony capitalism we have now. So I think that's a starting point for this conversation today.
I view Marty's book as sort of like the tip of the iceberg, you know, like it was like when the Titanic was heading full steam ahead at the iceberg. Only 10% of an iceberg is above the water, and then you try and avoid it and the entire hull of the boat gets scraped by the 90% that's beneath it. So it's like, as terrible as everything that's in Marty's book is, it's the tip of the spear. Things are so much worse. There's so much more damage than we could even cover in a single podcast. Like, shit is fucked, see?
Yeah, I don't deny that. Although what's interesting is that Marty's book actually points out a lot of bright spots where things are working. So let's say air ambulances, people are, you know, they're gouging people. They're owned by these private equity firms. They've lost their mission of actually serving patients, and it's more about serving the investors. So when medicine became this big business, a lot of the ethics and a lot of the nobility of it was sucked away. And I think people feel this. But so he points out to these organizations that have sprung up now that, you know, some of them just provide the helicopter services internally, like Geisinger, and some of them have companies that will actually price shop for you when it's not an emergency, right? When it's a scheduled transfer. So there are ways to get around it that actually, believe it or not, involve the free market. This is America. Okay, let's not lie that we're some kind of communist country. We're not. We're a bastion of innovation. We're the city on the hill, and we should start acting like it instead of being a bastion of crony capitalists who are in each other's pockets, legacy players that are gouging patients and healthcare providers, to be honest, because they're using us as commodities. And I think this is a passion of yours too, right, Tom? And because you're a kind of an anarcho. How would you describe yourself?
They call what I am ANCAP, which just means I think the free market can solve basically everything, which is true. Like, I think the free market can solve about 99% of things. Because if you think about it, there is going to be no more effective pricing mechanism than voluntary exchanges between human beings. So the more government interference you have between a voluntary exchange, it becomes an involuntary exchange when you put regulations in place, and then you have wonky prices. And we see what's happening, like, for instance, in healthcare, worst of the worst, because it has the most government regulation in it, that prices have fully decoupled. And so if you look at the graph from like 1971, when we went off the gold standard to where healthcare prices are now, you know, sure, things like technology have gone deflationary, where you get a TV for $300, but which, by the way, there's like this interesting phenomenon where everybody sells their TV on Craigslist for $350. And it's like, dude, you paid $400 for this. I can just go to Best Buy and get a brand new TV for $400. I'm not going to buy your old shitty TV for $400. Like, no thanks. Anyway, healthcare has gone hyperinflationary. And I think that this is something that, okay, for instance, like in 08, there was the whole, you know, there was the collapse, right? And who got bailed out? The big banks, right? Who's close to the big banks? All of the healthcare institutions, like large corporations. And this is something that's called the Cantillon effect. Do you know about, have you ever heard about this before?
I don't.
So the Cantillon effect is, it's a change in prices that results from a change or an expansion in the monetary supply. And basically anybody who's close to the new money is going to benefit, you know, and who are the people that are close to the new money? It's banks and large corporations. So when you see new money drive out old money, you have this sort of effect where poor people get further priced out of the market while goods and services rise in price. And this is what we see largely in healthcare. After, you know, 08, things got even worse. They accelerated. And now we're at a place where normal people just can't make up the difference. And, you know, Washington wants to throw you this bullshit, like you should have a health savings account. A health savings account is not going to do anything for you when your wages have fully stagnated and the price of getting basic healthcare services has gone up, you know, 30x since 1970.
Yeah. And I think this is the central point, is that until you control this cost rise, whether it's due to printing new money, whether it's due to the fact that healthcare is disintermediated from the free market by the insurance middleman. So it's always been insulated since employer-based insurance plans came online, because now you have a third party who's paying the cost. So the end user, the patient, is insulated from the cost until you actually look at where they're paying it, which is in terms of stagnating wages, in terms of economic stagnation, because the companies have to pay, foot this bill for healthcare, which keeps inflating because there's this strange middleman that'll pay the cost, which means that providers have to keep jacking up rates in order to fight the fact that insurance companies are going to keep denying. And it's this money game, which I think is at the center of what Marty's book is about. It's like we play these money games. Hospitals charge a shit ton of money in this marked up sort of charge master rate to fight the fact that the insurance companies keep, you know, reducing reimbursements. And it's this escalating money game. And who's caught in the middle? The patients, but also like people like doctors and nurses, because guess who gets blamed, right, when a patient goes bankrupt because of a medical bill? You know, it's the doctors, and they don't even know that it's a lot of times that it's happening. Now, some of them are complicit. One thing you said about the free market, I mean, it's absolutely true, but you've also said, and I agree with this, that unfettered, unregulated capitalism leads to slavery. And so there has to be some guidance, right? Like you cannot just, like a pure free market in healthcare means that somebody's not going to get care because they have no money.
Right.
So how do we deal with that?
It's super tricky because, you know, there's always going to be this, the world is always going to be in a fight between centralization and decentralization, and governments will always want to grow. You know, the government is in the business of being the government, and they're going to want to continue to be the government. So you say something very sensible, like maybe the free market does need a few regulations to keep tragedies of the commons from occurring. And the government goes, cool. What I heard is build a giant military and fuck everybody else in the world over. Is that what we're talking about? No, that's not what we're talking about. Right. I think so. Here's something I want to get into. Do you know what the World Health Organization's definition of health is? Because I have it here in front of me.
I don't, because I don't really care about the WHO. But yeah,
right.
Please tell me.
So since 1949, the WHO says health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, which at first glance seems kind of like a, you know, a pretty decent definition for all the things that we always talk about. Seems like they're pushing back a little bit on the idea that the body is a machine, but it also has this word in it that is really troubling to me, which is complete. And the word complete, it basically means limitless, right? So if there's any flaw in the quote-unquote machinery of the human body, well, then we have to get in there and fix it, right? And and in this system, patients are passive and doctors are the overseers who make these decisions about what is and what is not a good outcome for the patient, like what is and what is not health for the patient, when that should be something that the patient is making the decision on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually, you know, we have this term in healthcare, which I think is a kind of a another one of these wonky, stupid things that people invent just to keep themselves in business in the ivory tower. But the term is shared decision making. So the idea that the patient's preferences, hopes, dreams, fears, and goals matter, and the clinician's sort of wisdom and guidance matters, and together these two storm clouds meet, and you precipitate the rain of truth. But in reality, we ought to be weighing the patient's side of this much more heavily, because, you know, let's say you have an obese patient, but see, it becomes complicated. So let's say you have an obese patient who just doesn't care that they're obese. They right. like to eat. Right. They don't care that they're losing toes. That's not a concern of theirs. They just want to keep eating and watching TV. Let's say that's their goal. Let's say it's a pure goal.
And you I told you that in confidence, and we had some sort of confidentiality.
I don't believe in HIPAA. I consider HIPAA more of a guideline than anything else, just a gentle guideline. And so Tom wants his toes to fall out, and he wants to keep eating Chipotle. Actually, no, he wants to keep eating Popeyes. Pope, yes. And should we allow him to do that? Because that's his hope, dream, and fear, is to just be that. Well, the problem is when that affects the common good, it's kind of like vaccines. You can choose not to get vaccinated, but when you affect others, like people who can't be vaccinated and they die because of you, well, then you're an asshole and we need to do something. So the question is the obese diabetic who doesn't give a fuck, are they an asshole? Are they affecting the commons in terms of sucking up resources, in terms of showing up in the ER with complaints that are all due to the obesity? And then you have to abstract one level further and go, are they to blame for their obesity when they live in a food desert, they're poor, they can't exercise, various things happen. So it becomes this very interesting web of causality that you can't really pinpoint what's going on. So you have to think about all this when you're thinking about healthcare. And that's why it's much more complex than any simple reductionist answer can give us.
It's so tricky, because in some ways I agree with you, but in other ways, I don't want to give individuals that escape from responsibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, of course, some people are born into really shitty circumstances and really shitty environments, and that is going to color and affect the way you see the world. I mean, like, if you ever talk to somebody who is raised in poverty versus somebody who is raised in wealth and privilege, they just have very different ways of seeing and handling the world. So yeah, I agree. But also at the same time, you're taking away responsibility by telling people that they don't really have free will, and, you know, it's not your fault. Like, the corner store is full of crap, you know. You can make new decisions. Like, every day is a new day to change, you know.
I'm with you 1,000%. And this is something that, you know, again, my thinking on this has evolved. I used to be a pure systems advocate and say, you know, almost a nanny state advocate. Like, you know, people are dumb. They need a big brother to kind of guide them and take the sugar out of their drinks and that kind of thing. But now I'm like, you know what? You're a big boy. Put on your big boy panties. We'll help you by not doing really stupid systemic things that encourage stupidity, because oftentimes we do that. So poor systems design, which is why top-down architectures are often failures, like mandating electronic health records without really mandating interoperability and these kind of things that have led to, you know, bad outcomes, but encouraging some degree of personal stuff. By the way, the free will thing, I've evolved on that too, listening to Donald Hoffman more, just real quick on that.
Yeah.
Free will, you know, free will, yes, in the pure Sam Harris deterministic sense, if you really kind of go back and go, well, did I really make a decision, or did it bubble up from my unconscious from a place I don't understand, and then I acted on it? Well, yeah, that is true. But here's the thing. That bubbling up from your unconscious is actually coming up from a conscious place that you just don't have access to. So there's reasons you're bubbling up that decision that just aren't accessible to you. And here's the thing, you have override. So at your level of consciousness where you are aware, you can go, I really want chocolate cake. But you can go, yeah, you know what though? That's a bad idea. And I'm going to override my unconscious on this. And not only that, but you can condition your unconscious with better people around you, making better overall higher level decisions so that you're not surrounded.
This makes a lot of sense to me, because this is basically like, this is the cycle, right? So like, so maybe it's true that your unconscious stuff is coming up from, you know, 6 months ago, right? But what if you made new decisions for 6 months, and then your unconscious stuff would be new behaviors, you know?
And
we do see that with people who, you know, lose a lot of weight and keep it off, or, you know, all these sorts of things. It takes they say it takes 90 days to make a habit, right? So maybe it's 90 days to disrupt your unconscious flow.
And what is a habit? It's this momentum energy where I think our unconscious becomes conditioned to act in a way that is automatic. And the truth is, if you really drill down to what is the unconscious, it's a conscious agent underneath there making decisions that we don't directly access.
And then pull it apart in a fractal manner, right? So like there are probably cycles within cycles. So I'm probably living in some sort of a 24-hour cycle, in some sort of a week cycle, a month cycle, a year cycle, a 10-year cycle, a 30-year cycle. And these things probably keep coming up for me. And there are probably moments that I have the ability to disrupt these cycles. So you have to kind of wait for your time and then, you know, thread the needle, disrupt the cycle.
Get the wedge.
Yeah.
Get the wedge in there. Yeah. And people who are successful in losing weight or in changing their lives will all kind of say this kind of thing, that they had to generate this new habit energy, this new momentum. And so then I think having some accountability, but with tools, with compassion, and saying, you know what, I understand your struggle, but here's some tools that now I'm going to hold you accountable to use, and I'm going to help you. And that's what the healthcare system ought to be doing. It shouldn't be sitting there judging people, but it shouldn't be sitting there medicating to death people, where really the root cause is actually cognitive. So this gets to an interesting question. And again, it's a little bit of a derailment, but not really. So I had Dr. Harry over the weekend, and Kaiser System and others are struggling with, and you and I have talked about this before, and it has to do with this kind of idea of personal responsibility. They're struggling with this onslaught of people in their patients in their system that are suddenly woke about behavioral health. So they suddenly, the stigma is lessened, and now it's like just the common miseries of daily life. They want a therapist. So they are demanding that they be seen, and they want mental health services and so on, for the kind of complaints that typically in the old days we would have ascribed to ordinary misery. And so what ends up happening is you gum up the system because there aren't enough therapists, and actually the turnover on therapists is really high because they have to see all these patients. And they're sitting here going, you know, there are people with real, real mental illness that, I mean, everybody's suffering is real, but the thing is, there's mental illness that requires therapy, and there's mental illness where you can get off your ass, watch a couple of YouTube videos that give you the tools, evidence-based tools, things like cognitive behavioral therapy and the like, where in your daily life at home, you can make your life better, meditation, cognitive, you don't need a therapist. But now people have this entitlement mindset that, no, I need a therapist because I'm sick.
Oh, well, you know how I feel about this, because, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, my mother is severely mentally ill, hears voices, has, you know, extreme thought disturbances, et cetera, et cetera. And I hate this shit I see, you know, more and more, and especially from people in my generation, where it's like, you know, they'll say things like, being mentally ill, okay, just because I'm high functioning, like, doesn't mean I'm not a sad bitch on the inside. It's like, hey, shut the fuck up. You're not mentally ill. You just can't handle life because you're a pussy. You know what I mean? And everybody helicopter parented you, and you've never been outside without like a chaperone, and you're 27. Shut the fuck up. I'm sick of hearing you. You're not mentally ill.
You know what I mean? Oh, man. You know, and again, who's to
blame
for this?
Listen, well, none of you are mentally ill. If you get a little depressed, you get a little anxious, that is not mental illness, and you need to shut the fuck up about it. Okay? Go on a walk, exercise, eat right, spend time with friends. Basic shit. You know what I mean?
Tom Heineberg. That's a great quote. Shut the fuck up. It's ordinary misery, right?
Yes, exactly. But, which is what Freud called it.
Right. Exactly. There's a silver lining here, which is, okay, we're destigmatizing mental illness. Great. But there's a bad dark side to this, which is you're gumming up the works a little bit in terms of availability of providers. I mean, our behavioral health specialist at Turntable was booked solid. And many of them were worried well, but many of them were really sick. And, you know, she saw all of them, but it's kind of like, listen, we need to give people educational tools for how they can manage their daily shit, especially since we've made them so fragile by raising them wrong, right? Which is our fault. It's like we helicopter them, we coddle them, we give a culture of safetyism, all the other things that Haidt and others talk about.
Yeah. Listen, overparenting leads to adult learned helplessness. That's exactly the path you're going to get. And what is overparenting look like for that? It's like if you're paying for your adult child, any part of your adult child's life, if you're paying for that child, that's overparenting. If you're bailing out a child or not letting them face natural consequences, that's overparenting. If you're intervening and directing a child's relationship with their friends, siblings, whoever, that's overparenting. Like, if you're highly emotionally reactive about your children's circumstances, that's overparenting. Like, let your fucking children outside. Stop doing things for your child that they can do themselves. You know what I mean? Like, some of you need to stop being such anxious little bitches all the time because you're ruining society. All right.
You know, I'm 1,000% with you on this. You know, this weekend, one of the advantages of moving back to the Bay Area is there is this interesting community here where, you know, we live in a little cul-de-sac and all the neighbors kind of know each other. And so over the weekend, the kids, you know, my two daughters were like, you're just jumping out of their skin, and we're like, you know, bitch, go outside and figure something out. So they go outside, they go knock on the neighbor's door, the neighbor's little kid comes out. The next thing you know, these kids have disappeared for like the whole fucking day. And then they come back, they're covered in sap, they've got scratches and bruises, they've done some shit that I'm like, that was a risk-taking behavior. And I was so happy. They were like lit up. They had learned to take and manage risk. They're less fragile, they're more anti-fragile, they're gaining strength from adversity. And yeah, I had to take Goo Gone, which is not something you apply to the skin, and apply it to the skin to take the damn sap off them. And yeah, I was pissed that they ruined their clothes, but at the same time I was like, damn. And you know, it was liberating for us because we got to be adults and do what, you know, get shit done. So you know what's weird, Tom, is like I could never do that in our gated, guard gated community in Las Vegas. We just didn't feel safe.
That's interesting psychologically. Like if you put up walls around yourself, you know what I mean?
You kind of feel like it's not safe as it is. Yeah.
I'm going to quote a great man here, Mike Tyson, who said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the fucking face. And here's what I mean by that is, if you've never been tested, right, and you walk around scared and anxious, well, you have good reason to walk around scared and anxious because you've never been tested. You've never gone through anything, okay?
Right.
So you don't know what you're made of, and you don't know when you're going to be tested and when somebody's going to pull your card, when life is going to fucking punch you in the face. You just don't know. So you do have good reason to be nervous and anxious. And what I'm telling you is, if you were the kind of person who was overparented and you find yourself in this cycle of adult learned helplessness in any shape or form, like, you need to test yourself and get out of it. Find a way to push your limits. Go towards what you're scared of. You know, this is what children naturally do. And it's only when we interrupt that cycle that we make bad children who become bad adults who then want safe spaces. You know what I mean?
You know what? You triggered me, Tom, and you didn't give me a trigger warning. So now I'm a little bit butthurt. I'm just saying. It's 1,000% true. And you know, the truth is, what's weird is I was overparented and underparented at the same time. So I had a...
That happens.
It happens.
You have like a mother that's overprotected. Yeah. And then a father who's like,
Whoop. And then dad completely distant. Yeah.
What do you mean? Ruben? Is something wrong with him? Like, that's not his name.
That's not my name, dad. That's not his name. That's right. Why are you always calling him Ruben? I told you we named him Zubin. So yeah, overprotective mom, underprotective dad. And then both of them gone for vast stretches of time where I had a Trinidadian nanny. Growing up in New Jersey, and she'd be like, hey, Z-Dog, you know, never mind what I'm smoking now, but you go and watch TV because that's your real babysitter. And so I watched Land of the Lost until, you know, I thought when I grew up, I wanted to be a sleestack. So, you know, it all worked out, Tom Heineberg. It all worked out.
Dude, it's actually amazing, too, when you start taking control of your own life. Like, that's a cycle that really... that cycle really, it changes everything for you. You just little decisions to take control of your own life will change everything in your environment, how you think, how you feel, how you act. It will change your mental health. And it's simple stuff. Just the decision, I'm going to eat right today. I'm going to go to the gym today. I'm going to stand up for my boundaries, or I'm going to stand up for what I believe in. Those things are so simple That's what we used to call conviction or moral character. And we don't have it anymore. You know, like I often think about Martin Luther King Jr., who said, you know, I hope we live in a world where my children are not judged by the color of the skin, but the content of their character. And then I think about the new left who wants special treatment just for the color of their skin. And they think that, you know, the color of your skin is the most interesting thing about somebody, and that that should be, that everything's power and we're all just playing power games. And these people with this color skin are holding down these people with this color skin. Why doesn't everybody with every color skin just focus on being a person of high conviction? Because I'll tell you, the more I walk the path of being a person of high conviction, the more I see how few people are walking the path. The path is basically empty. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So the far left and the far right both share something, which is tribalism. So
yeah, well, the far right is like, we're special because we're white. And the far left is like, we're special because we're not white. None of you are special. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, shut the fuck up. Yeah, every I mean, when you drill, oh, by the way, dude, so speaking of special, so when you drill down into this, and I've really been actually getting into Sam Harris's lessons on his app. So he has these conversations with Jack Kornfield. He had a conversation with Locke Kelly. He had a conversation with Rinpoche, one of the Tibetan lamas that he has trained with. And
yeah,
those conversations are really fascinating, because he's basically, it's funny to watch Harris kind of work out his own shit with these teachers. And you know, you can tell Harris is like you. He's the scientist archetype, right? He has to be right. He's like, he's searching for the right answers. And you have these guys saying, actually, right is a state of mind. And as long as you approach it the correct way, you don't have to necessarily technically be right. And you can see him kind of straining against that. But the idea that, like, you know, nobody's particularly special, yet we're all kind of infinitely capable of just recognizing moment to moment the nature of our own awareness and seeing that it's actually as special as anything gets, and it's shared with every living creature. And then you start to go, you know what? I'm going to shut the fuck up. I'm going to do my part in this vast ecosystem of consciousness to make it less shitty for myself and others. And that's all that being a person of high conviction really means. It
yeah,
just means
totally.
I'm dedicated to this shit. Like, I'm going to cause less suffering and more well-being for as many entities as I can, including myself, which means I have to forgive myself. I have to work on myself. I have to try to recognize and see when I'm being an asshole, which is hard because we don't see ourselves well. We don't have the process or capacity to understand how we behave. So we get glimpses of it.
Totally.
And you sit, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
you need to. You're the only thing. You and your decisions are the only thing that you can control in this entire world. And this, okay, so a lot of Z-Packers follow me on my personal Facebook, which is a bad idea because, listen,
that sounds terrible.
I'm just gonna light you up. Like, I don't give a shit. You know what I mean? Like, if we're having, you know, if you're having a cognitive distortion, you know, your version of being punched in the face is meeting Tom Heinemann on Facebook. but I put up this thing, and I just said, imagine having tattoos, LOL. Which because my here's my personal feeling, Z. Tattoos are the dumbest thing imaginable, and there's nothing substantive about having a tattoo. And we now live in a society where everybody has tattoos, and it's become herd behavior to have a tattoo. So how are you some type of special individual for having a tattoo when every other asshole looks like you who has a tattoo? And I get it. Listen, you're 18, you're dumb, you go into the tattoo parlor, and you feel shitty about yourself. So what do? You try and polish a turd by getting a special butterfly on your forearm. That is not a good look, okay? You need to work on yourself instead of trying to convince people that you're special because you spent 8 hours getting some dude named Jeff to jab you in the arm with a needle and now you have Hep C. Okay?
You know what? You know, Tom, I guess you're not really taking to heart my tattoo that just says respect. And you're giving me the bare modicum thereof, and I don't respect that.
Well,
okay?
when I saw it said R-E-S-E-P-C-T, I was like, that's not it, Z. That's not correct.
Yeah, when you have a typo in your tattoo, that's when the game is afoot, as you know, Sherlock would have said.
Oh my god!
I mean, look, dude. Like,
I was going to get to a larger point though, which is a lot of people are trying to do this, in which they don't feel good about themselves, so they're trying to basically polish a turd, and they do that in all sorts of ways, which is, you know, like, you know, a lot of the moralizing conversation that we're seeing is people projecting a large moral canvas to basically cover a large moral problem with themselves, which is, you know, and it's, and once you realize that everything is projection, that's all you can see everywhere. And it's like, that's what people are doing, is they're just projecting their own shit out onto the world. And, you know, I'm doing it all the time too. You're doing it all the time too. There are just different levels of it. And some of it is kind of base and pathetic.
Projection is a fascinating phenomenon. It is, as you say, rampant. And when you learn to tune in to it, you see it everywhere, like you said, but then you start seeing it in yourself and you go, oh shit,
yeah,
I am absolutely projecting. And you know, this idea that that is a defense mechanism, right, to defend the ego, because the ego is the centerpiece in an unenlightened person of everything. And you need it to survive. You need to develop a healthy ego, but then you need to at some point transcend it and see it for what it is, which is a tool, not a identity. And when we identify with that ego, that's when the shit hits the fan. It's interesting. So those transient moments when I've identified not with my own separate self ego, this is whatever the Zubin character is that I'm defending against, you know, attack online, or I'm, you know, projecting out into the world as this thing that knows what it's talking about. When I actually go, oh no, actually I'm this field of awareness in which this Z-Dog character arises, and I can see it from the separate, more inclusive, more, you know, equanimous viewpoint and be at peace. Oh, that's liberating. And you only get glimpses of that, right? Unless you sit in a cave for years. But even in the worst, like, you can be having an argument with someone and then you can detach into that point of view, and suddenly you come out back into the argument from a place of wisdom instead of reactivity. It's very hard to do, but it's doable, which means we should strive towards it.
I like the person who, you know, clicked on this podcast. They were like, ooh, healthcare pricing. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah. The next thing you know.
So it's like,
every time.
Well, I can, you know, okay. So why are we always talking about, you know, this kind of stuff, like the egoic self, and, you know, everything's a field of consciousness, and, you know, maybe all experience is relative and subjective and everything. It's because, like, okay, think about insurance companies, think about basically all human bodies as machines, right? And then something goes wrong. There's a flaw in the machine. So that's a coverable event. It's like a house. Like, there was a fire in the house. We can cover that. You know what I mean? Except, like, that's not how human beings work. That's just not it's not what it is.
Let's dive into that. That's fascinating. It made me think of something. So, okay, insurance treats human bodies like cars, like machines.
Right.
So when they go ba-da-boinga, and everything, the spring breaks and whatever, that's when they're there to help you, cover you for that. And it's probabilistic, and there's actuarial claims data. And so you charge prices based on age and, you know, risk and pre-existing conditions. And that's how you cover a machine, right? Just like you would pay more for a Ferrari that's going to break for their insurance, you can pay less for a Honda Accord, which is pretty stable.
Exactly.
So now here's the question. Do these insurance companies mechanistically actually cover, should they be covering the oil changes and the tire rotations and the preventative maintenance at 20 and 30 and 100,000 miles and the timing belt and things like that? And the answer is, well, no, an auto insurance would never do that. So why the fuck is health insurance in the prevention business? The prevention is not a machine. This is a complex human being with hopes, dreams, and fears, and attitudes and responsibilities. That is the purview of a relationship with another human being or a team of human beings. And that's why I'm always advocating, you know, when you talk about Medicare for all, you can talk about it, that's fine. But it should be a catastrophic, true insurance for when the machine is fucked up. But before that, that's where the government should think about, and employers should think about, and individuals should think about, how do you pay for, and what do you pay for prevention? And the answer is, well, we've actually kind of looked at that. If you have a really good relationship with somebody, whether it's a therapist or a primary care doc, or whether it's a health coach, I don't care who it is, and you're paying for that, whether it's your insurer whether it's your employer or the government, or you paying for that out of some health savings account, who cares what it is, as long as it's fairly equitable. So, like, you know, people with economic means cover their own share, and people who don't have it helped out. Well, then you actually start to change attitudes and desires and habit energy, and people start to improve their lives in a way that prevents needing the Medicare for All catastrophic insurance unless something mm-hmm. terrible happens. You get leukemia, you get in an accident, you know, you have a genetic disorder, then it's there for you. And that is the ideal system of personal responsibility, paying for prevention differently than you pay for failure of prevention, and incentivizing people to do the right thing. That's what we need. And that's why when I did the piece on Medicare for All, you know, a lot of people push back. They're like, well, no, that's what Medicare for All is saying. It's like, you're going to fix primary care. No, you're not. You're going to cover it with the government. Shit's going to go all fucked up. It doesn't work in Canada in the sense that you're still not encouraging prevention. You're still, you know, you haven't fixed that model. You're just making sure everyone's covered, which is actually very admirable. And the Canadians really will say that's, hey, this is, I can't understand how people can go bankrupt. And that's true. Well, but how about we actually focus on what works and do it in a uniquely American way where everyone's covered and it saves money and we have better outcomes and the rest of the world can fuck themselves in the ass because they haven't gotten it right. So you know what? I'm more jingoistic and more like, you know, in many ways I hate America. I feel we've done terrible things in the world. And in many ways I'm like, this is the only country that has any hope of getting this shit right because we're fucking America and we have the chance to do it. Why are we trying to flush it away because a bunch of communists want to fucking socialize medicine here? Fuck that shit.
Nobody is saying.
Okay, I said too much.
Listen, no, nobody is saying that America is perfect. It's just that America is the best so far. You know what I mean? Everything else is worse than America. I'm sick of hearing this shit where it's like the Nordic, you know, in the Nordic countries, man, it's like when you talk to people that are actually from Norway or wherever the fuck, and I have, they don't like their system either. You know what I mean?
Everybody complains about their system.
Right.
I mean, that's just part of it.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders put out a tweet the other day that says Medicare for All means no premiums, no copays, no deductibles. And then my favorite response to the tweet was Medicare for All means no innovation, no availability, no escape.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. You know what's funny though? Both of those tweets represent a simplification that is necessary when you fight on Twitter. So Bernie Sanders' people are actually very smart. He knows who his base is. He knows who he's appealing to. So no copays, you know, no bills, this kind of thing. It's like, well, yeah, that's what they want to hear. And honestly, it's an oversimplification that is hiding the truth, which is it's going to cost a shit ton of money. People are going to have to pay very high taxes. Now, the truth is it already costs a shit ton of money, and we pay a tax in the form of low wages and inflation and printing more money to pay for it. So already it's broken. So we need an answer, but there's no simple answer like both these sides are saying. And by the way, the libertarians are wrong on this too. Just like, let's go out and put out a bunch of direct primary care clinics and let them compete and people will pay out of pocket for it. Dude, that just doesn't work. It healthcare is a weird thing where you do need a safety net. You do need some sort of structure to it that requires systems thinking, because otherwise you end up with people just gouging and crazy shit happening. And even in a perfectly free market with perfect competition, that shit will occur.
Well, we always talk about, I'm, you know, pretty anarcho-capitalist, which means like, I would like to see the destruction of everything that's government regulated. Like I would just like it to be all, I would like it all burned to the ground, but we do need some sort of a social safety net. I can agree with that. And so I guess I'm sort of a minarchist, like a minimal anarchist, like in that regard. But we always talk about compassion for, you know, the people that are suffering, right? What about compassion for the people that are paying for everything, Z? What about compassion for them? You know what I'd like to see? Okay, I'm okay with having a social safety net where people that need the help are getting the help. You know what I want? One of the people who's fucking paying for it. I want to make sure that the money is going where it's supposed to be going. Have some compassion for me, a person who is giving up little pieces of my life to make somebody else's life a little better. Have some compassion for me and make sure the fucking money goes where the fuck it's supposed to go. Is that so hard?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's essentially that gets to the heart of how people have these very strong moral palates, right? So that's a fairness versus cheating moral taste bud. And on the right, it manifests as exactly this, which is, how is it that I take care of my shit. I'm accountable. I work hard. I pay taxes. And then Buttfuck McGee over here is just sucking at the public teat. And then on the left, it manifests as, how is it that people can, in the working poor, can work and struggle and they're the victims of racism and bias, but then Donald Trump is born with a silver dick in his mouth and, you know, and gets everything and it's all momentum and he can just cheat and, you know, not pay his contractors and this and that. So it's really fascinating. I think you have to acknowledge there's truth on all sides of that, and then we have to work towards the best solution. But ignoring one side or the other is going to lead to no solutions.
And yeah, but I don't like the highlighting of the highlighting of edge cases that goes on. Like Donald Trump is an edge case. You know what I mean? Most people that most people that have money do well in business by doing well for other people. Creating actual value. Not many people, you know, and Donald Trump didn't do that well. He could have put his money in an ETF and done better. So he screwed himself by cheating other people as well. And he basically just overcomplicated every business deal he ever did. He also seems to have no understanding of basic risk reward. I mean, the man is an idiot. Like,
he's a physical moron.
But I don't like that we're highlighting these edge cases where it's like, okay, maybe the Koch brothers are evil, and you know, one of them's dead now. But maybe they're evil assholes, and you know, of course they are. I'm sure they are. But you know, there are a lot of rich people who have built services that we all use and enjoy. You know what I mean?
I concur with you 100%. But then if you look, it's the same, by the same token, you can say, you know, when Reagan talked about welfare queens, first of all, that was kind of a made up thing, but he's pointing out an edge case, like, you know, the person on welfare who's out there living it up and this and that. It's an edge case. I think most people who are on government assistance are trying in some way to get off. And the ones that aren't, though, are poisoning the sort of well. And it's the same with, I think, the ultra rich. So I think if we understand all these edge cases and start to discard them and focus on how do we encourage what is effectively the center, which is everybody else, we can actually come up with some solutions. But see, ideas like, you know, like Bernie Sanders, when he uses that language, it's just not correct. I think it's partial. It's true, but partial.
Yeah.
You need to look at all angles of it. You know who actually surprised me? So I know you're not a fan of Andrew Yang's you know, universal basic income, and I don't understand it well enough to think of it beyond how stupid it sounds.
What, Yang Gang? Yang Gang?
Are you a member of the Yang Gang?
Bro, I'm Yang Gang 2020, dog.
So, full disclosure, Andrew Yang ran Venture for America, which Josh Poineau on my team was a member of. So I was connected to Andrew through that organization, and he was really a true, like, capitalist. Like, that's what he was... there to do. So,
yeah.
But so it's interesting. So when I did the Medicare for All rant, the Yang Gang kind of weighed in and said, this is effectively what Andrew Yang is saying. And they directed me to his healthcare platform. And I read it. And it actually said, it made some of the right noises about, look, you need this catastrophic insurance, but you need to focus on what actually works, which is, you know, primary care, preventive disease. You need to restructure the care delivery. And I think that's all true.
Andrew Yang's a smart guy, and I do agree with a lot of what he says. I disagree with the core tenet of his entire platform,
which is UBS,
which is universal basic income. Now, here's where we might agree. I am actually not opposed to a debt jubilee. You know what I mean? Like, but I don't think we can have a debt jubilee in the modern era because of how things are structured. So because of the securitization of debt and the financialization of debt, well, we're not going to be able to just so easily, with a stroke of a pen, erase all the debt, right? So what's the modern version of a debt jubilee? Print a shitload of money and give it to Main Street. But as a one-time thing, not as an ongoing, recurring, on the government dole for the rest of your life.
Help me out here. What is a debt jubilee? I haven't heard this term.
Well, so in ancient history, debt jubilees were just, it's exactly what it sounds like. You would just erase all the debt because things would just get too crazy. And, you know, it's like a situation that we find ourselves in now where normal people are never going to pay back their debts. They're in a situation where they're looking at, you know, 40 years ahead of them with stagnating wages, and you know, they have $150,000 in student loans and they can barely make the interest payments on them, you know, because of the way the system is set up. So the system is broken. And in ancient history, the system would break too, and you would have to have a debt jubilee where you just canceled all the debt. We can't cancel all the debt in a modern society. So what you'd have to do is you'd have to have a bailout for Main Street, which is like they had a bailout for Wall Street. And because of the Cantillon effect, it made everything fucking worse. Wealth inequality is worse than it was before. And we're now at a fever pitch in our society where like shit could get really bad really quickly and we could be living in Hong Kong before we know it. So what we're going to have to do is print money and give it to regular people. But, you know, they're going to have to use it just for debt. That's going to be the strings attached to the money. So here's X number of thousands of dollars. Print down your debt. There you go. We're done. Now Main Street got the same bailout that Wall Street got and everybody. Because the problem with UBI is you're permanently. It's taking away agency, accountability, and responsibility permanently, and all the money just goes back into the economy. So prices rise, and it really does.
It's inflationary.
It really does nothing, ultimately.
What is Yang's argument about the inflationary piece of this? Because I haven't really heard him speak about it. I haven't had a chance to listen to him on Harris or some of these other podcasts.
I haven't heard him address what I just said. I've heard him say a lot of bullshit about automation and how it's going to, you know, take away trucking jobs, which sure, but truckers will figure out something else to do because
what?
We don't have a lot of jobs we had from the pre-industrial revolution era. There's nobody, I don't even know what those jobs were, but there aren't a lot of people doing, you know, horseshoes anymore. You know, there's some people doing horseshoes, but not that many.
So, but now they're artisan, they're deep game artisans where, you know, this horseshoe was handmade in Petaluma by Bob McGillicuddy, who comes from a long generation. Whereas back in the day, it's like, where's the horseshoe guy?
I think
bring him over here.
What I would say about Andrew Yang is that he's directionally correct, but his implementation is dog shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
That's fair. Like, we should get him on the show and we should debate it.
Yeah. Well, he's like never going to be president, so it doesn't fucking matter anyway.
Yeah. Do you think that's true or do you think he'll be like a wild card? I don't think he'll actually get elected, but do you think he'll actually get the nomination?
I think it's going to be Bernie Trump, which is what it should have been in 16. Although Bernie will be now, he'll have his hamstrung. He'll be hamstrung because, you know. It's been 4 years. Trump's the incumbent. It's hard to beat incumbent presidents. Anybody that thinks Trump's not going to win in 2020 is fooling themselves. Trump is 1,000% going to win. You heard it here first. Because, you know, personally, I know a lot of liberals who got the tax cuts and are now going to quietly vote for Trump. They're not going to talk. They're not going to talk about it. But like, I talk to people all the time. You know.
You know what's funny is. I actually have, I'm more incentivized to vote against Trump because he actually cost me money on taxes because of getting rid of the interest mortgage, like basically hurting the blue states.
Well, it doesn't matter how you vote. You can just skip it. You don't even
because the blue states, it doesn't even matter.
You're in California. I'm not even gonna, like, it doesn't matter.
I'm not even going to register to vote because first of all, my vote is wasted. Second of all, I'm going to end up getting called for jury duty. And I hate that shit because I'm not a good citizen, Tom.
I saw a sign that was so great and it was like somewhere in Texas and it said, "Welcome to Texas. Stop trying to make it like the liberal shithole you left." You know? and then it said, "Vote Republican," you know.
You know, I've gotten so much shit from my more conservative elements of my audience for moving back to California. They're outraged.
Yeah.
They're like, "How could you do it? What are you thinking?" Well, and I'm like, you know,
you're going to be the first. I mean, you know what I mean? You're literally living on a hill in a place with one of the worst wealth disparities in the country. They're coming for you first with the pitchforks.
I want them to get me because, then I can find out what happens when you die by pitchfork. You know, I've been always wondering. Yeah, this is fucking the whole thing.
See,
polarity.
My thing is that people are not stupid. I think people are actually, you know, pretty good at making calculations that benefit their own lives. But it is so goddamn impossible to save money with the way the money system works currently. So what do poor people end up doing? They end up storing their wealth in things like a vehicle, which, you know, is not a great place to store wealth, but is actually a kind of a better place than keeping your wealth in cash over a certain time period. So some of these are very rational decisions that they make. And, you know, human beings make rational decisions to reach outcomes. I don't want to use the word rational. Human beings make decisions to reach outcomes, right? They're not always rational, but
right.
I think for the most part, people realize that, like, things are fucked, and that healthcare is the worst of the worst in terms of how fucked everything is.
Well, and this gets again to bring the conversation full circle. So holding patients, say, accountable, forcing them to behave as consumers, having them make rational decisions, that's a high bar. And yeah, some of the data seems to show that it's hard to get people to do that, which is why I think some degree of systems architecture at a minimal level. So in other words, requiring people to have a primary care physician, and they can compete. So a primary care physician can compete with each other openly, but saying, you know what, if you're going to get this HSA subsidy to pay for preventative care, the only way you're going to get it is if you sign up with a primary doc and you stick with them and you go see them and you don't flake on your appointments and this and that. And if otherwise we take that money away. Like, I think holding some accountability there through a system might help the patients, because then that primary care doc can help them make decisions based on what their hopes, dreams, and fears are if they're a good doc, right? Which we're going to try to train. So, because you have to change how they're trained too. That's the other problem. The culture of medicine is so fucking fucked that even if you pay for it all with Medicare for all, you're paying for a fucked up culture. Like, medical school is a shitstorm of stupidity right now. The way we train these people, the way we condition them, and then they come out totally screwed up. I mean, I talk about this in my talks and stuff. By the way, I'm just going to throw away the current talk I do. I like it. But it's run its course. My next talk is going to be, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to talk shit about everything.
Yeah.
Basically live. And if you like it, great. If you don't, maybe you need to look at the parts you don't like and see what's triggering you, because the hard truth is it's time to stop being filtered about stuff.
Yeah. I think that's a killer. That's a killer idea. And don't you kind of think that modern medical school has a convergence towards the machine model? You know, like,
the way you start, 1,000%.
Right. Everything's a building block, and you have to understand that the body emerges from the conceptual, you know, integration of these various systems. That's a machine. You're talking about a machine.
Right? 1,000%. When a Western doc talks about holistic care, they're talking about looking at the whole machine. So I'm not just looking at the engine. I'm also looking at the drivetrain and how they interact.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not holistic. That's partially holistic. It's not holistic. And so what ends up happening is you empower these quacks and dipshits, you know, to then come out and be like, the Western model is broken. You should come to me and I will give you herbs and spices and we'll meditate on your chakras. And it's like, well, okay, now you've gone the other direction. Now you're just too stupid. So there is a convergence where you can see the bigger picture we've talked about this before. The brain, the way people think the mind works, is always influenced by the technology, the techno-economic development of their era. So in the Victorian era, people talked about the brain in terms of steam engines.
Right.
So yeah, there's pressure building up and you let off steam. And even Freud used this language, the language of steam engines. Then we get the computer revolution. So now people talk about the brain in terms of computer circuits. Well, there's this, you know, OCD, it's a broken circuit where it's just on loop. Is that correct? Probably not. What's the next era? Well, is it quantum computing or is it conscious agents interacting? Well, then we'll have a different model. So, you know, we're still just apes scraping around with meat holes flapping at each other, doing our best to evolve in a vast social network. And so we have to recognize those limitations and be humble in the face of them. I don't think modern medicine does that.
No, it doesn't. And that's why we haven't had any significant developments in modern medicine in over 50 years. There have been almost zero. I mean, yeah, we sequence the genome, but like, what the fuck are we doing with any of that data, you know?
In terms of affecting daily lives of people, I'm not highly disagreeable with you. You know, it's like vaccines, sanitation, better nutrition. And even then, we don't even focus on nutrition. Nutrition is like the central aspect of what, you know, makes people well or sick in so much chronic disease, but we don't, and stress, we don't focus on the mind body integration. It's not even connection. It's just mind body, right? We don't focus on that. And so what happens, so by the way, we're going to have a great guest on the show on Thursday. We're going to probably record that and put it out later as a CME episode, Dr. Rinesh Sinha.
Right.
He's next up on the show. So he's been on the show before, but I did it ghetto with a phone. He was recently on Peter Attia's podcast. It was a great conversation about South Asians, metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, diabetes, low carb diets, all this kind of stuff. But really, he's an expert now as well on the general levels of unhappiness in the Silicon Valley, how people are stressed and miserable, and how it's creating disease in a population that's known to be strivers, South Asians. So you have all these Indians coming from India, they're coming here and they're fucking killing themselves. Like, they're dying, you know, of heart disease in their 30s and 40s. They're getting cancers. Their women are getting polycystic ovary and these diseases of insulin resistance. And then they're pushing their kids to fucking become doctors and lawyers and engineers in this vicious cycle of just misery. So we're going to talk about that. And I think he's going to help us understand some tools where you can actually improve that, coming from that background himself. So these are conversations I think we ought to have. And then, you know, we'll keep doing that kind of shit more and more since we're in the Bay. We'll get these fuckers on the show and talk to them.
Listen, part of it with the Indians is, if I know my Indian brothers and sisters, they love fried chicken, Z. Okay? And that sounds like a joke, but these motherfuckers actually love fried chicken. Like, when they come over here and they get on the American diet, they go ham. They go ham.
Dude, you know what? You know what? I can't lie. My mom and dad used to take me to KFC as a kid. Like, every week we'd have a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's like crack. And, you know, and they're like, oh, 13 herbs and spices. You know, mysterious. We don't know what they are, but one of them has got to be masala.
No masala. It wasn't India, but I think maybe it was Dubai, and there was a report that, like, you know, KFC is like a fancy meal out for the people of Dubai, and so it's like they love, and they're getting all fat and everything because it's like, yeah, you're eating chicken fried with industrial seed oils, like you're gonna get fat, you know.
And you're going to get these diseases. It's not just fat. This is metabolically active visceral fat that has direct access to your bloodstream and releases not good things and causes not good things. And that's a whole nother discussion. All right.
I got to tell you about how deeply insane I actually am. So
you have to tell me about this? I intuitively know it.
A belief that I hold actually fairly strongly is that because of the fiat currency system, we have fiat food. And fiat food is something that, because of the government's subsidy of corn, we see all these, you know, carb-based, corns, high fructose corn syrup-based foods that are high in sugar and carbs, and it's one of the reasons that everybody has become fat.
Interesting. So you're relating our overproduction of fiat currency, aka the US dollar, that's not pegged to anything worth actually money. In other words, it's just pegged to the reputation of the US.
Yeah.
It's not pegged to gold. It's an inflationary currency. By using that currency, the government printing more money, subsidizing corn, creating fructose, we've created big food, cheap, abundant, and unhealthy food that then is foisted upon people who can least afford good food, and they're dying. So you're saying basically the government is murdering us with fiat currency.
I am 1,000% saying that.
And you know what? This is one of those rare times when I don't think you're crazy. I think you're right.
I think you can track. I think you can track it pretty easily, especially because of the farm subsidies. Like, it's there and it's real.
Yeah.
And guess what happens when you give government infinite power to do top down architecture like this, to do things by fiat, by decree? You give them the power to say what is and what is not in reality, instead of hundreds of millions of humans, you know, creating their own systems and coming to their own conclusions in reality. Like
an open, open data transfer, open networks. Yeah.
Look at, for instance, like the war on meat. There's this new sort of thing happening in the vegan circles and the environmentalist circles, where we're supposed to eat this Beyond Meat crap that's just basically a bunch of oil and junk. Like, I'm not eating that bullshit. Meat is one of the most nutritious foods on the planet for the entirety of human history, and it's probably the reason why we are the dominant species. So, no, I'm not going to be eating your crap tofu soy burger bullshit. Like, fuck off.
Now, I would, however, eat a, you know, a lab created literal meat.
That's because you're a lizard.
In other words,
what?
No, if it could be true
one to one, but we're nowhere close to that, not at scale.
Yeah, but we can get there. I bet we can, because the only thing is, I do worry about the there's environmental costs to raising cattle and things like that, but also there's this ethical thing that I have where I'm actually convinced that cows, even though they're pretty dumb and stupid, they have conscious experience. If we can kill them without making them suffer, I'm actually okay with that. But like, you look at a pig, which is pretty fucking smart. And listen, I eat pork all day long because I have a cognitive dissonance around this, but shit, these are smart, suffering animals. If we can actually raise them in a way that doesn't cause them to suffer, I'm fine eating them. If we're torturing them in systems where that's not true, then I think we may wake up one day and be like, oh, we've been bad.
No, yeah. I agree with that too. Obviously, nobody likes factory farming. Like, the most ideal version of harvesting meat is to just go to the wild and put a bullet in something's head so that it just
lives. Oh, yeah.
It's living a wild, free life, and then one day, just from behind, it gets struck down with a bullet. You know, that's the best way to harvest meat. Like, I don't think what are the cows being fed, Z?
It's subsidized corn.
So yeah, this is in everything. And so this is why it's one of the things that I'm most passionate about. And obviously it leads into the whole, the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And there's a whole conversation about that to be had that goes really deep, but
and that's for next time. But I would say this,
next episode of the next show.
I just realized something. You know, why are we feeding cows corn? And they talk about grass-fed meat, right? No, it's pasture-raised. We should be feeding, now that it's illegal almost everywhere, we should be feeding cows real grass, marijuana.
Yeah.
And then you can have a dope-fed cow, like a chronic meat. And think about how flavorful and juicy and psychoactive that meat would be.
You know,
I think it would transform.
There are people that are actually doing this.
No way.
I've heard about it more so with pigs, but yeah, you can get marijuana infused pork where they feed they feed marijuana to the pigs.
Oh, snap. Well, here's a question. So we're going to put this podcast out. It's Tom and Z Morning Rounds. You should subscribe on iTunes or whatever podcast service you use. If you want to become a supporter of the show, go to facebook.com/becomesupporter/ZDogMD. And for $4.99 a month, we have these kind of private discussions in a closed channel where the people aren't allowed that are assholes. And it's great. There's about 7,000 people there and growing. So you should definitely join that. But there was a piece of this. Tom, do you think we need to write show notes for this shit and like put it on the website and do all that? Or should we just put it out and let people listen? And if they like it, fuck it.
Let's just put it out. I think the people that need show notes are assholes.
I agree. Fuck them. So if you're asking me for show notes,
I've never used the show notes for any podcast that I actually like. You know what I mean? Like, the people that want the show notes don't want to actually listen to the podcast. So like, fuck off. I'm not going to do extra. I'm not going to do extra work for you so that you can just read my show notes. Like, blow me.
You know, it's funny. So MedPage Today is always posting my shit on their website, and they post the full transcription to whatever interview I do. And I was like, you know, I don't really like that. I like my shit consumed by video. And they're like, well, the majority of our readers prefer to read it. I'm like, well, that's called an article. That's not called a video.
Right.
And the way that we talk, it doesn't play well in written form. It looks retarded. I'm sorry, developmentally delayed. And so I don't like that. It's like when you read things that Trump says, you think, boy, our president literally has no brain. But
right.
Then you hear him say it and you're like, you know, he doesn't have a brain, but at least he expresses himself.
There was it's just well, Obama clearly used to write his speeches, right? Or have other people write his speeches for him. And there was this, I forget which tragedy, maybe it was like Mount Hood or something. After it, he goes, you know, we consign these souls to eternity. Their names echo in the sounds of, you know, whatever. And it was this very eloquent, you know, poetic sentiment that he wrote. Trump, who clearly doesn't write his speeches or have anybody else write his speeches. and it was some tragedy. I forget which tragedy it was, but I read it in print and it was like, Trump, so sad, very, very sad. Which, like, you know, if you were talking to somebody in real life and they were like, oh, so sad, very, very sad. You'd be like, okay, yeah, it is sad, you know.
That's what but you get.
If you see somebody the president
who
written
gets
in print,
all his
like,
news
so sad.
On TV.
Very
so
sad.
Very sad. Very sad.
It makes him seem dumber than he is, you know. And he is dumb. He is dumb.
He's dumb. No comment, because I know the NSA is listening to this. So, guys, hit us up, subscribe, review this podcast on iTunes. It helps us a lot to move up through whatever non-existent charts that we don't give a fuck about. So, actually, don't even bother. We don't give a fuck what you say. I love you guys. I hate you guys, but I love you, and we're out. Any parting words, Tom Heineberg?
Yeet.
Yeet. We out. Peace.
Peace.